Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're spending the hour listening to some of our favorite Studio 2 interviews with people who think a lot about music, as well as musicians.
And we begin with our chat about the Bruce Springsteen album Born in the USA. The title track has become a patriotic anthem despite its deeper message about the difficulties of life in our country. Writer Stephen Hyden recently published a book about the song and the album called There Was Nothing You Could Do, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and the End of the Heartland.
Hyden joined us to talk about the impact of the song, its legacy, and its political history. We began the conversation by asking him about Springsteen's career prior to this massive hit and how Born in the USA was a major departure from his previous work.
When Bruce Springsteen first came on the scene, he was the scrawny, scruffy-looking guy. And in his personal life, he was essentially a loner. You know, he liked to read books. He didn't really hang out with people. He was prone to depression. You know, he wasn't necessarily like this sort of macho all-American person that you would have guessed that he was if you looked at the videos from Born in the USA or the album cover. But, you know, there was a physical transformation that happened with him in the early 80s where he started working out. He got much more muscular. He became, I think, a more kind of conventional sex symbol, which, by the way, it's not like he was this was happening to him without his consent. I mean, this was something that he put out there. He was the one that went on stage with like sleeveless shirts and,
you know, exactly.
He's looking really handsome. but I think it did put him in a weird place where if you look at how he was being written about in 1984, 85, there was a common thing that op-ed writers would do with him where they would compare him to Sylvester Stallone, you know, because Sylvester Stallone was at his peak as a movie star at that time, making the Rocky movies, making Rambo, these very rah-rah, almost jingoistic type action movies that were really big in the mid-80s. If you know anything about Bruce Springsteen and you're looking at the lyrics to his songs, that's clearly like the last thing he wants to be known as.
Yeah.
You know, he was writing very thoughtfully about Vietnam veterans and how they were mistreated by society and how we need to pay attention to these people, very much in line with him, you know, speaking up for the underclass, speaking up for the little guy. So again, I think it comes back to this loss of control that always happens when you become that successful. You lose control over how people perceive you, how they talk about your art. You have people that are maybe liking your art for the wrong reasons or reasons you didn't intend. And clearly that was something that Springsteen was dealing with at this time. And I think it's affected how he looks at that album, quite frankly. Because he's always expressed mixed feelings about Born in the USA.
Yeah, some like, ambivalence for sure. Well, is it part of the confusion, though, Stephen, the fact that the songs themselves musically have a strong beat and a rhythm? They kind of sound happy, but if you listen to what they're talking about, they are often very sad. And I think this is the perfect place to bring in Dancing in the Dark. We have an excerpt here from perhaps the most popular track from this album, at least some people would argue. Let's hear a little bit of Dancing in the Dark.
I check my look in the mirror. Wanna change my clothes, my hair, my face, and I ain't getting nowhere. I'm just living in a dump like this. There's something
and this guy hates himself, right? I mean, he wants to change his clothes and his hair and his face. And yet you listen to the song and you obviously want to get up and dance. So what was Springsteen trying to accomplish, Stephen, by marrying these happy sounding songs with these really downbeat themes?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a songwriting approach that's unique to Bruce Springsteen. A lot of people have done this, but he is one of the masters of it, where, like you said, you take this music that is so ingratiating. Like you hear the song and you want to hear it again. And then you look at the words and it's so sad. And you mentioned Dancing in the Dark being the song about self-hatred. You have a song like Glory Days, for instance, that a lot of people, when they hear that song, they think, oh, this is just a straightforward song about how life used to be great when you were young. And it's actually a song about how nostalgia is a trap, how it's empty, and how at some point you're going to be an old person who's just reminiscing about these stories that no one cares about.
Yeah, just sitting at the bar kind of talking to yourself almost by the end of it.
Right. I mean, I happen to think that that makes these songs richer.
Yeah.
You know, that there is like a multidimensional quality to them. I mean, the title track is the most obvious example of this, where people hear that song, they hear the chorus. It's such a grab you by the throat type chorus. I mean, you want to pump your fist and shout along with that Born in the USA every time you hear it. And then you listen to the verses, and it's about this disaffected Vietnam veteran who's been rejected by the world, and it feels very alienated. But he's not rejecting America. He's reminding you that I am a part of this country too, and you can't forget me. Mm. You know, I am claiming my citizenship. But yeah, that's a song that was, you know, it was appropriated by the Reagan campaign in 84, which I think was done so knowingly and cynically by them. But then you still have just millions of people who are just innocently misreading that song. It reminds me of a song like This Land Is Your Land, you know, the Woody Guthrie song, where people hear that song and they think, oh, it's just like a nice campfire sing-along. And they forget the later verses that are a little more pointed about America. So that's a tradition that goes back a ways. It exposes these ideas and themes to people that
to
might
not have
seen
a broader audience,
Right, right.
Absolutely.
And since you were talking about Glory Days, we're going to play a little clip of that. Go right ahead before I... And I mean, and for the overarching message to be that nostalgia is a trap and we're bopping into this.
It's a heck of a Trojan horse for sure.
I want to ask you, because you talk about this in your book, Stephen, that, you know, Bruce speaks to men with his music, expressing a, quote, deep-seated, tortuous, inarticulate, and intractable masculine pain. And you say this is a power that Bruce Springsteen has. It's almost like a therapy session. Can you talk about this power that he had to sort of summarize and express, you know, the angst and just sort of like the feelings of so many men, many of whom never shared those types of feelings?
I think he is writing a lot in his songs about guys who can't express themselves. And in the lyrics, they're trying to come to terms with who they are. Oftentimes they're trying to come to terms like with their fathers. I mean, that's a big theme in his songs. And I think that's something that for the men in his audience, it'd be something that they relate to. They see themselves, I think, in the characters of these songs. And what Bruce Springsteen does is he offers catharsis to those people musically. So, you know, you can go to a Bruce Springsteen concert and you can cry. His best love songs are about other men. Like he writes a lot of songs, romantic songs about male friendship. And an example of that is Bobby Jean.
Yep.
A song that by now everyone is aware that he's writing about Steven Van Zandt.
Who's a member of the band, yeah.
Member of the band who exited the band during the making of the record. And a lot of people hear that song and they think Bruce is singing to a woman. And you could certainly hear the song that way if you want. But he's really singing to this man that he loves. And he's not, you know, putting it in like coded language to conceal that. It is open love for his friend. Yeah. And he's wishing him well. And he's sad that he has to go, but he wants him to be happy and free in the world. Again, like just for me as a kid hearing that, I think that was a positive role model.
Yeah.
That like, yeah, you can love your friends and you can be honest about that and open about that. Like that sort of emotional release valve, I think.
Yeah, let's do a little healing right now. Actually, I'd love to play Bobby Jean for folks who don't remember. This is a great track. Let's hear a little bit of Bobby Jean from Born in the USA.
We like the same music. We like the same band.
That's Bobby Jean, really about Stephen Van Zandt, who's a member of the E Street Band. You mentioned earlier, Stephen, that the Reagan campaign ends up using Born in the USA and kind of twisting its meaning, you say cynically. But one thing you write about in the book is that Born in the USA comes out in 84. It's an election year, right? And Springsteen, even though this album is really a repudiation of Reaganism in many ways, does not endorse Walter Mondale, who was Reagan's opponent that year. And he sort of just stays above the fray. But since then, Springsteen has been much more explicitly political. He's supported many, many Democrats openly. I mean, is that a sign of Bruce changing, or is that a sign of the times changing, that kind of flip?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I think with Springsteen, you know, he obviously has become much more explicit in where he's coming from. I think there was a belief that if you listen to my songs, you'll know where I stand. And the Born in the USA experience proved that that wasn't true, because there are people, whether you're on the left or the right, you can look at Bruce Springsteen almost like a Rorschach test, and you can take from him what you want and apply it to your own ideology. And there were people on the right who did that, who looked at him as like a traditional male archetype, you know, talking about hard work and values, and he believes in the American way, and then they disregard the rest. And at some point, that wasn't good enough for Bruce, and he did start coming out and endorsing candidates, and he played the Vote for Change tour in 2004 and all that. But we live in a world now where I think people expect that more.
Yeah,
I don't know
if that was, exactly.
Like in 84, I don't know if people were expecting. I mean, there were certainly activist musicians back then, but I don't know. It's different now. Like, we expect famous people to give endorsements, like they're a newspaper editorial board or something. I think that also speaks to just how the culture has changed.
And real quick, follow up on that, in terms of not letting it be a Rorschach test anymore, you mentioned this performance that Springsteen does of Born in the USA in our region, Upper Darby, right outside of Philly, in December of 95. You know, he's about to play Born in the USA, and he says something really remarkable. What does he say, and what do you make of those comments?
He basically says, if you're a Republican, you probably got the wrong idea about this song.
He calls out Republicans for misinterpreting the song and sort of, and then I think he says something like, but there's probably no Republicans in the audience, which is fascinating, right? Because he was supposed to be this great unifier back in 84.
And we know a lot of Republicans love Bruce Springsteen, you know, starting with Chris Christie, you know, the former governor of New Jersey, the most famous, you know, which I always think it's fascinating to know that your hero probably doesn't like you, you know, like can you imagine, like, you have this hero and you're like, oh, they probably don't like me back. But so that's what, that's interesting about that comment, that he would say that, because I think there probably definitely were Republicans in the room. But I mean, I think, you know, there's this thing with Bruce Springsteen that, you know, we know where he comes from politically, but he also has always been this centrist type person. And, you know, he's been more explicit in terms of his beliefs, he's also like not backed away from that idea. And there was that Jeep ad that he did that ran during the Super Bowl. I think it only ran once, actually, but it was in 2021, and it was literally called The Middle. And it was Bruce, he's in Kansas at a church, which is like in the geographic center of the country. And he's saying that the middle is this sacred ground in America, and all are welcome, and we need to come together. And that's an idea that I think it's up for grabs right now. And it feels like a lot of people don't necessarily believe in that anymore.
Yeah, so it's an interesting touch point for sure. And it's a great book. And thank you so much. I wish we had more time, but we don't. That is UpRock's cultural critic, Stephen Hyden. His new book is There Was Nothing You Could Do, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and the End of the Heartland. Steve, thanks for joining us. That was Stephen Hyden, author of the new book, There Was Nothing You Could Do, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and the End of the Heartland.
When we come back from the break, we'll listen to one of our favorite interviews, a conversation about the changing face of music and the impact of streaming on the industry. Stay with us. This is Studio 2.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald
Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry, remember the good old days? You went to a record store or a CD store?
I do.
To get your hands on something you were so excited to hear.
Showing up at midnight, waiting in line.
For what album?
That was the Biggie Smalls album after he died. Life After Death. I remember waiting in line at midnight because it was like, it came out like a couple months after he passed away. Yeah. So it's kind of crazy.
And you waited at midnight for that
I
album.
Waited at midnight and I got it. I still have it in a box somewhere.
I don't think I ever did that, but I was very excited to get, what was the big Will Smith album? Was it Big Willie Style? Willennium? Something like that. So, someone gave that to me as a gift. I think that was my first CD.
Go ahead. Look, the memories, right? So, but a lot of times people are not buying albums anymore, and we are clearly in a world where most of us listen to our favorite artists via streaming platforms. I know I do.
We've got old formats. We've got new formats. We are still kind of feeling our way into the future of music. So to help us, we invited a local panel of music professionals to give us some behind-the-scenes perspective on the state of the industry. With us in studio are Jeff Apruzzi, Program Director of the Music Industry Program at the Antoinette Westfall College of Media Arts and Design at Drexel University, and Brielle Kimmons, a local recording artist also known as April Fool Child. Jeff, Brielle, welcome to Studio 2.
Hello.
Hi.
Jeff Apruzzi, how do musicians actually make money these days? I can't imagine a huge chunk is from those old school formats, but maybe I'm wrong.
A variety of ways, I would say. One way I often like to describe it, especially to our students, is that instead of, you know, in these old school days of an artist signs to a record label, gets a big fat advance, records a record and tours, we have a much varied resources now to all the different revenue streams. And unfortunately, streaming has not been a direct replacement for physical sales. But just to give a little bit of ballpark right now, the recorded music industry is currently a $28.9 billion industry globally. And physical actually makes up about $5.1 billion of that. Okay. So almost 20% of the recorded music industry globally still is a physical format.
And then streaming is most of the rest?
Streaming makes up about 60% of that, yeah. But unfortunately, you know, it is not a direct replacement. We're talking about pennies per stream, fractional pennies per stream, if you will. So it's coming from a lot of different places. More artists are forced to tour, and we've seen those headlines now just even increase costs with tour. Artists doing licensing, branding deals, sync deals. There's a lot of different areas now that have opened up to increase some of that lost revenue.
So it sounds like a lot of little revenue streams instead of like that one big chunk.
Yeah, correct.
Which feels a little precarious, or it would for me as an artist, but maybe some artists like that model.
I think it really depends a lot now. What I'm seeing is ways of engaging with the fan base, right? And I think the fan base is truly this place now. So take TikTok, for example, right? If we rewind back to 2020, the music industry was sort of looking at TikTok as this development platform, right? You can find artists from there. They can develop a fan base. What they found was that a lot of the artists that were popping off on TikTok had never played a show before. They didn't know how to play an instrument, right? And so what now has happened, fast forward about 4 years, is that authenticity is really the key. And so artists are really finding unique ways to connect with their fan bases a lot more and figuring out ways to, for lack of a better sense, monetize those relationships in a more direct-to-consumer way versus having to worry about this vast commercial viability that we might have seen in the recorded music industry in 1999.
Interesting. Yeah. And so, Brielle, we want to bring you into the conversation. Tell us a little bit about your story, how you got into the industry.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I always had interest in music as a kid and spent time developing, like, you know, training and being in choir and singing. And then as I got older, found resources like Berklee. Berklee had a summer program, and that's how I started there. getting acclimated to what it's like to be a performer, be around other instrumentalists, and start learning about the industry. And from there, creating organic relationships. So finding pockets within the music world that fit my sound, booking shows, even if they were small shows, and just building an organic network, like Jeff said. And then from there, finding that the best way for me was to put out music independently. I did have an opportunity to work with Universal, and I felt like a very small fish in a large ocean. I just wasn't getting the resources I needed to kind of move from, you know, that independent kind of DIY artist to the next level. But I found that the relationships I built mm-hmm. with my community was strong, and I could continue to put out music just by myself. So I used like DistroKid, which is accessible to lots of artists.
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so it's a distribution hub company that you can access as any independent artist. You just sign up. You pay for basically like an annual service fee, and you upload your music, which is great. And it syncs automatically to PROs. So it's going to track your performance royalties so you can get paid. Yeah. And like Jeff said, right, like we're getting pennies, but there's a lot of great ways to, you know, sell your music to your fans.
And that's what I want to ask you, because Jeff sort of laid out that there's multiple streams of income coming in for artists. So how do you as an artist create enough multiple streams of income where you can support your actual life?
Sure. You definitely got to get crafty. So I would say being organized is a great way to create opportunity. Go through your catalog, have it set up. Reach out to different agencies, like sync agencies. They love discovering new artists, especially like, you know, independent, little different sounds. So I took my catalog and I pitched it to an agency called Mad and Flow. And so they work for me. So whenever opportunity comes up and it fits like a commercial, an ad, indie film or TV that works for my sound, they'll reach out and say, hey, we have an opportunity for you.
So licensing.
Yes,
of your
licensing.
Music.
Yeah. There's also a really great vinyl opportunity that I found called Least of All, where you go to New York and you record something from your catalog, which is a great way to engage with your fans. And you're cutting this music live with your band, and it's a one of one record. So your fan feels like, wow, I got this really special, amazing custom thing. And it doesn't cost the artist any overhead money to make the music. You're splitting it with the distribution.
So. Interesting.
All the stuff that you're describing, Brielle, I'm imagining like, even 10, 20 years ago, you would need an agent and a manager mm-hmm. and all the resources of a big record company to make a lot of this stuff happen. And now it's so much more, it sounds like, decentralized. So then, Jeff, I ask you, what is the role of the big record company these days? Do they still have a role?
Yeah, I mean, so going off of that, right, like access has been completely democratized, right?
Yeah.
Like there is very little barrier to entry. And so anyone can get their music out there, which is great. But it also makes things difficult in a way, too, because I think the last statistic was that 100,000 songs are uploaded to DSPs every single day, right? Mm-hmm. So think about that. Think about the fact also that Spotify just also released information that starting this year, songs that don't track at least 1,000 streams per calendar year won't receive any royalties at all. So mm-hmm. It's great that we are able to invite artists and invite people to contribute and be a part of this, but it also makes it really difficult to have a career. And so I think the roles that major labels play still kind of occupy a very similar space, which is what do you want to be? What do you want to do, right? Taylor Swift is obviously very fresh and still on everyone's minds. If you want to be Taylor Swift, a lot of the times you need a record label, right? Mm-hmm. Record labels...
To get that scale.
In my mind, right, record labels are a bank and a vast marketing engine. You know, they're a vast marketing vehicle to get out there. And so really... And a lot of this can be done independently, but when you're working with sort of a larger label or any label at that, you're kind of relying on the expertise of them to sort of analyze the marketplace, kind of see what the music sounds like. How do we get this to actually stand out in the sea of 100,000 tracks that are uploaded every single day?
I got to ask you both, what is the best way to support an artist to make sure that your support actually impacts their bottom line?
I mean, if you're looking for direct contributions, merchandise, purchasing music directly, if it's physical, from the artist, and concert tickets, right, are usually the best ways of supporting an artist. Merchandise is such a vital piece of, you know, revenue for, it's one of the biggest ancillary revenue streams for an artist. And when you think about Spotify's payout model, right, it's this pro rata payout model. It's basically a share, a proportion of how many streams they get into the overall proportion of how many streams the service got. So it's not just because I listened to Taylor Swift, you know, 20 times or 20,000 times, she's not getting my $15. That's in a proportion to all of the overall streams. And so the most transparent ways to transact and give money to an artist are those direct revenue streams, whether it's vinyl or a t-shirt or, you know, a poster, things like that.
And Brielle, that is that how people can actually, the money goes to you and not to Spotify in a way?
Yeah, I agree everything you said. Also, like, sites like Patreon are a great way to have concerts get comfortable performing. If you're kind of new, like the TikTok stars who may not have performed before, you can perform in your own space, and your fans can pay some sort of subscription or virtual ticket, and then that money is going to you directly.
But what role do some of these older formats of music play in the livelihood of the modern artist, talking about cassettes, talking about vinyl, and even CDs?
I think it's making a comeback.
Yeah.
Especially with social media, lots of kids now are getting into it, and maybe it's a fad for them, a trend, but, you know, having something tangible as artists grow, you want to feel like you're a part of that journey with them. So I think it's very smart to create tangible, physical music.
Moving now to the future, artificial intelligence and AI songwriting. It is here. It is happening. What is AI songwriting? And what does it mean for musicians? I know that's a tough one.
Yeah, it's really interesting. AI songwriting in and of itself, there's a really crazy app called Suno. And a friend of mine posted a picture on Instagram the other day, right? And it said, create me a song in the style of Her and make it about Joe Biden. And within 3 seconds, it had a song.
Wow.
3 seconds, it had a song. Maybe I wouldn't listen to it, but the general public probably would not know that this was created by AI. And it's kind of fascinating. A colleague of mine, Joe Steinhardt, and I have been doing some research on AI-created music and fan acceptance. And we created basically these narratives where a band is recording a record, the lead singer passes away, and they use AI to finish the recording. And in both the scenarios, scenario one, we let the audience know, okay, we're using AI to finish this song. In scenario number two, we didn't let them know that we're using AI, but they use it anyway. And what's interesting is that the people that we sent the survey to, there are around 1,000 respondents globally, the fan culture, they actually didn't care that AI was used to finish the song. As long as they were made aware that it was used, they were okay with it. The discrepancies became for, if songs are created using AI and people aren't made aware, they tend to not want to engage with it. And so I think it creates this really weird time in the music industry where, you know, are we getting to the place where music that's created by AI is going to sit, you know, toe-to-toe with music that is created solely by musicians? And then how do we evaluate those two pieces of work?
And I think about this recent dust-up between the estate of Tupac and Drake, who used an AI rendition of Tupac, and it sounds just like him. And Tupac has been dead for more than 25 years at this point, and a diss track. And the family sent a cease and desist letter. Are we ready? And I just want you to come into the conversation, Brielle. What concerns do you have as an artist about AI?
Sure. I think it is concerning, right? Because we put our heart and soul into our music, the time, the energy, the feelings. But I think that organic feeling of music, like if you go to a live show and a band makes a mistake, we're going to appreciate that more. We're going to learn to appreciate that more because that won't happen with AI. It's pretty much perfect. So I think that gives us a fighting chance. And I think, you know, that organic sound will survive because of things like that. People are going to crave that authenticity even more.
I want to come back to you now, Jeff, and ask sort of a Philly-specific question. With all these changes in the music industry, is it easier or harder now to be based in a city like Philadelphia and make a living. And by that, I mean not L.A., not Nashville, but a place that has a real music scene, you know, and is a major American city. I mean, do you think it's easier, harder now to be in a place like Philly?
Specifically speaking about Philadelphia, I think it is in a way easier.
Interesting.
I actually had been doing some research recently about the built environment of Philadelphia and specifically looking at the DIY music scene here. And if you look at sort of the physical makeup of the row homes and how the close proximity and our access to public transportation, you have this big coalescence of scenes and music and artists that are so, they're so, it's so easy for everyone to interact versus when you look at larger cities like New York or even Los Angeles, where you have so much segmentation of different genres and art, it really keeps things separated. And so there's this big melting pot, I would say, of music genre opportunity here. And I'm an outsider, right? I've only lived here for about 6 years. I've lived in New York and Los Angeles. And I do see this different sort of ecosystem here where the music scene is so supportive of one another. And to your earlier point, right, like living in a city like Philadelphia, you can afford to live here. You know, you live in these major cities, you might be working 40, 50 hours a week to pay your rent. And then how much time do you have left to work on your art? Like in cities like this, we have this great flourishing art scene. You can afford to live and spend a lot of your time honing in on your craft. Mm.
And Brielle is going to perform in just a couple minutes. And I have to ask you about performances because, you know, a couple people commented. One guy, Paul, says his favorite band is Phish. He sees them 3 to 5 times a year. 13 times was the most time he saw Phish in 1 year. Just sort of to piggyback on Avi's question, just sort of performance art, being able to perform in venues, does a city like Philadelphia encourage that? And given its proximity, does it just make it a little bit easier to make that real money?
Absolutely. I mean, I think live performance is sort of one of the biggest opportunities, again, to earn revenue for an artist, especially a major artist. And to Ria's earlier point, like there is that, the biggest thing is that fan engagement, right? Like to me, that is the biggest piece. And when I think about myself as a music fan, live performance is what really has made or break, like broken my love for a band, right? Like when I've seen a band perform and they just absolutely smash it, you go home and you listen to that record differently versus if you see a band perform and it kind of tanks, you're like, oh, I don't know anymore.
I got to say, Brielle, I heard you perform live and I'm so excited you're in studio today and you have some live music with you. And this song is called
Expectations. Al, let's roll that tape and have Brielle play us out.
You realize
vinyl merch support Brielle Kimmons.
Yes, and tickets to live performances. Absolutely. That's how you support artists you love.
And Brielle, by the way, is known as April Fool Child. Thank you so much, Brielle, for the time today. That was lovely. That was beautiful. I needed that today. Thank you, Brielle.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We also talked with Jeff Abruzzi, who is Program Director of the Music Industry Program at Antoinette Westfall College of Media Arts and Design at Drexel University. And I should note, a former member of the very influential indie band Passion Pit. We actually didn't bring that up, Jeff.
But, and I heard some of the music. I was like, I know this song.
That's right.
So that's really cool.
So obviously Jeff knows this stuff, and we really appreciate the time, Jeff. And you're listening to Studio 2. When we get back from the break, we close out our hour of music by listening to our conversation with Philadelphia jazz musician Terrell Stafford. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manert.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We have devoted this hour to listening to some of Studio 2's best music-themed interviews. We're going to close out with our conversation with one of Philadelphia's most respected musicians. In fact, you can hear his melodies right now. That's jazz trumpeter Terrell Stafford with the title track from his recent album, Between Two Worlds.
Terrell has an impressive list of collaborators, including the likes of McCoy Tyner, Bobby Watson, Christian McBride, and many, many more. Stafford is also the director of jazz studies at Temple University, and he joined us in our studio to talk about and play some jazz.
Hmm.
We're so happy to have you. You got the trumpet with you right there.
I have the trumpet with me.
We talked about it before you came on. Doesn't have a name.
Doesn't have a name.
And we... it's funny because we had Mr. Trombone on, Jeff Bradshaw, on Studio 2, and his instrument definitely had a name.
Okay.
So obviously there's two opinions on this in the musical community. Why no name?
You know, I've had the unfortunate opportunities that I've had trumpets stolen. I've lost them or they got destroyed, and then you get close to it. And so now I look at it as my trumpet is not as a vehicle for me to share my heart. You know, it's a conduit just for me to express what I need to express. So that's where my passion lies. My passion lies in doing as much as I can to play it really well. But outside of that, I'm okay.
Let it go.
Understood. Okay. And how did you fall? I read a little bit about you falling in love with the trumpet, but tell us the story.
Yeah, so, you know, I was a youngster and my cousin actually played trumpet. He played trombone and he played baritone, and you know, he put him in the closet at my grandmother's house, and my grandmother said, don't go in that closet. Well, of course I had to go in that closet. And I took the trumpet out, and I would stare at it, because I would say, how all the music that can come out of a trumpet and it's only three vowels, how does this work? And so I never tried it at that moment, but I was always fascinated, how can you get music out of three vowels? And so all my life, every time I grew up in Florida area and then moved to Chicago, and I told my band director, I said, I want to play trumpet. They said, you can't play trumpet your first year, you have to play a stringed instrument. I was like, no. You know, I don't want to play stringed instrument. But then finally I was able to play the trumpet, and my parents say to this day, you know, when I started to play, I've never put it down. I love to practice my trumpet. But you know, when I first started to play the trumpet, my dad really wanted me to play jazz. And none of my friends were playing jazz, so I didn't want to play jazz. I wanted to play classical music. And so that was great and everything. And so I did, you know, mostly through my high school years playing classical music, through my undergraduate playing classical music. And then when I got to graduate school, I went to hear my hero, the guy by the name of Bud Herseth, who was principal of the Chicago Symphony. And he said to me at this dinner, I went to hear him at Carnegie Hall and then met him after. And he goes, you know, Terrell, you should be more well-rounded. You should, you know, yeah, you should play classical music, but learn some jazz. I was like, no, I don't want to learn jazz. He goes, why not? I said, because it's not safe. He goes, what do you mean it's not safe?
Interesting.
I said, because there's no music. He goes, well, that's okay. You have to use your ears and trust others. It's more communal that way. I said, yeah, but I'm really used to seeing what's on the page. So he told me, take a chance to start to learn some jazz. Get away from the paper and see what it does for your ears.
And now you've been featured on dozens of different albums, have more than a half dozen of your own, mm-hmm. and won a Grammy. And your latest one is the title of the album is Between Two Worlds. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you've been kind of caught between two worlds on a lot of different ways. Can you talk about this going back and forth thing that you do on different levels?
Sure. So, you know, my aspirations, like I said, were to play classical music. But when I started to play jazz, the things that happened for me were, A, I got to meet some incredible musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't make music with others if we aren't tight, because there's a level of trust. And I just found that so different in the jazz world, like hanging out and, you know, after you play the music, you're in an environment that's communal. So you're hanging out and then for my Between Two Worlds, it's like between the world of jazz, between the world of classical, between the world of jazz, and between the world of teaching and and parenting and, you know, relationships. And the pandemic actually just woke me up to say, how were you doing all this stuff before you slowed down? How are you juggling all these worlds? And then now, how are you going to continue to juggle them after this pandemic is over? And I just found it fascinating how many people juggle so much. And then to play this music, I'm juggling so much in my mind. I'm thinking about the melody. I'm thinking about the harmony. I'm thinking about what the bass is playing, what the drums are playing, what the piano's playing. All these things, I'm between everyone's world because I want to listen to me the least and base what I play on their worlds.
Speaking of being a parent, I believe this track that we have queued up, Mia Mia, is inspired by your daughter. Is that right?
It is right. Yeah.
Can we hear a little bit of Mia Mia? Nice tempo there.
Thank you.
First of all, how was it inspired by your daughter?
So my daughter, when she was three, she started to play the piano. And it was so beautiful because I would just love to sit in the house and hear her plunk notes and things like that. And her piano teacher's from Costa Rica. So she came home with this rhythm. Boom, 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 boom. She goes, look, Dad. And she'd play that. And so one night at dinner, she goes, Dad, you have this new record. What music are you going to play? I said, I don't know. Maybe I'll play this. And I went and I started to play the bass line that she played. Uh-huh. She goes, Dad, that's my bass line. I said, well, let Dad borrow it. So I borrowed her bass line and I built the rest of the tune off of the bass line that she had been practicing.
What a beautiful piece of collaboration.
Collaboration, that's right.
I absolutely love it. And you have your trumpet.
I do.
In front of you. And so we'd love for you to play a selection for us live.
Sure.
What would you like to play?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I switched from classical to jazz, the hardest thing was to say, okay, jazz musicians know all these songs, and there's so many great jazz trumpet players. How do you figure out what you want to play? And so I listened to, like, Clifford Brown and Dizzy Gillespie, and the music was so complicated that I couldn't even handle it. But there was one trumpet player by the name of Miles Davis who played a song. And I'll play a little bit of a song that I heard him play called Bye Bye Blackbird.
So what about that song struck you? Because you said the other music seemed inaccessible?
Yeah, because it was so many notes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, ah!
Yeah.
But that song, I heard Miles Davis sing it, but the thing I didn't say in the quick story about Mr. Herseth is that he said, you know, when I was in the Navy, I sat next to a guy. He played principal in the concert band. I played principal. He played first trumpet in the jazz band. I played first trumpet. But he learned how to improvise. And I was like, Mr. Herseth, what's his name? And he goes, his name is Clark Terry. Mm-hmm. So Clark Terry made this song, in addition to Miles Davis, made this song really popular. And so when I heard Miles Davis play it, I heard Clark Terry play it, and Clark Terry would sing it. I was like, I love this song. It's so simple, but it's so beautiful. I'm about simplicity when I play. Even if I play something complex, I want to make it simple.
Yeah. Why is that? Is it with the audience in mind, or is it just sort of that's what fulfills your soul?
Fulfills my soul. Yeah. I love melody. You know, I grew up playing hymns in the church, the most beautiful melodies you could ever play, you know, or spirituals. That's what I grew up playing. And so I just have this affinity towards melody. And even when I improvise, if I'm not improvising the song, if I'm improvising off of a song, I still want you both to hear the melody inside of what I'm improvising.
Yeah, I want to ask you about improvisation, because one of the things that I love about jazz and that I fell in love with it is that you when you hear them live, you never hear the same song. It's always different and it's constantly growing and expanding. Do you have a theory of improvisation? And you're the band leader a lot of times. So what's your theory on this?
Well, you know, I think improvisation, I mean, I think, you know, from an educator point of view, there's so much tangible things you could teach. You could teach theory, you can teach chord scale relationships, et cetera, things that are in books. But I think the things that make jazz really important to one of each, you know, as listeners and to musicians, is really saying sometimes that jazz is a theme, and it's, you know, we take a theme and then we have variations of that theme. And depending how far we go away from the theme, is based on our improvisation and what we want the listener to hear. So, for example, can I play something real quick?
Of course. Go ahead.
Here's the theme. We all know that.
Yeah.
So my next variation would be. Here's another thing.
Now, that takes a level of skill, though, but that's a next level skill, because you have to know the song really, really well to be able to then, you know, improvise and create new melodies.
I mean, what was the bridge between, so the first one, it was Happy Birthday, right?
Happy Birthday.
Yeah.
What, and then the second one, I totally heard it, but then as a layperson, by the time you got to the third one, I was like, I kind of hear it, but I was second guessing myself almost. Right. Was I still hearing it? How do you get from one to three? What's the bridge there?
So if we had more time, I would bridge that gap for you, you know, and start to go farther and further from the theme. And then it's going to be up to you to see if you can hear the theme. Yeah. And that's what keeps you engaged. Did I hear it? There it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's how, like, a basic solo can evolve. And, you know, there's space that you leave in the solo. I like to leave space, too, to give you a minute to think. Like, what was Terrell thinking right there? You know?
I got to ask you about the future of jazz, because you work with a lot of young people. And I've seen a lot of classically trained musicians now. They do jazz fusion. They fuse it with hip-hop, rock, all sorts of things. What do you think it'll take to keep jazz relevant and keep it growing and changing and evolving?
You know, I think it takes openness, you know, because every genre of music has something that's really unique. And I think there's a link between every genre of music, even classical music, you know, because you look at the form of classical music, it's a similar form to what jazz musicians do. So there's a thread that goes through all genres. It's being open enough to say, hey, I dig jazz, I dig rap, I dig classical, I like Mozart, I like Beethoven, I like Coltrane, I like, you know. So being open enough to appreciate everything that's going on. But the question you asked about the future of jazz, just last night at Dizzy's Coca-Cola Club in New York, my Temple University jazz band played last night two sets. And we had this guest, her name is Akiko Saruga. She's a great organist. And we were kind of calling it like a tribute to Shirley Scott, because Shirley Scott's from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. But to see a packed room and my students playing, and there's so much joy in the room. And then after we finished, it was just like this communal thing at the club. They could not get people to leave. People just wanted to hang out. And I said, you know, this is what this music, it's about community.
Yeah.
And if we bring people in, yes, and play music that people are, feel a part of, that's just going to continue to build community and to build, you know, a gathering of people who want to support the music. So I think the future is phenomenal. I think it's great. I feel great about it. I know there are a lot of naysayers who say, oh, there's no place to work. That's not the – if you're not working, there's a reason. And it's not necessarily the one finger you're pointing and why you're not working. It's a three pointing back at yourself. So when you can check that.
All right. Yeah, but, Terrell stays booked and busy. Yeah. So
I like that. What I like so much, we were talking about in the prior segment about feelings of isolation and the idea of an event that is community based,
uh-huh,
that is different every time, that's about showing up. I do think that can appeal to people more and more because they're missing that,
yes,
in their lives.
And absolutely, it feels so good.
Yeah. Well, fascinating conversation. You just heard Terrell Stafford, both voice and musical voice, world-famous jazz trumpeter, director of jazz studies at Temple University. His most recent album is Between Two Worlds, released in 2023. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much, both.
That's right. Training the next generation. Ooh. And that, friends, that is it for our show today. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes, Al Banks, our engineer, thank you. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
Tomorrow at noon, we will be back for another hour of Studio 2. And we want to remind you that you can always get in contact with us. The email is studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 215-351-0525 and tell us what's on your mind.
And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at whyy.org. We would really love to hear from you. Coming up next, it's Here and Now.